Special coverage from WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook. Today, Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld told reporters that cruise missiles and bombers will not win the war on terror. It's going to be a scrap of information, Rumsfeld said. But will the American intelligence community know that information when they see it? And who will find it? Since terrorists pulled off a spectacularly successful attack on American soil, the Monday morning quarterbacks have come out in droves. The CIA and its brethren are stuck in a Cold War model, they say. But some of the harshest critics are on the inside, and they sounded the alarm long before the World Trade Towers crumbled. Our special coverage correspondent, Jonathan Saltzman, reports.
Frederick the Great, the King of Prussia, stressed the importance of military intelligence in the 18th century. It's pardonable to be defeated, he said, but never to be surprised. On September 11th, America was surprised by the worst terrorist attack in the nation's history. Now the U.S. intelligence community is under fire for failing to anticipate it. Of the 13 government agencies that gather intelligence, the CIA and FBI have been subjected to the most scathing criticism. Experts attribute the failure to factors that range from institutional complacency to misplaced priorities, from a fear of taking risks to ignorance of Islamic fundamentalism and Middle Eastern languages. Senator Richard Shelby, the ranking Republican on the Senate Intelligence Committee, has gone so far as to call for CIA Director George Tenet to step down. But experts say it will take more than shuffling personnel to address the intelligence disaster. Ruel Gerecht is a former Middle East specialist at the CIA who left the agency out of what he described as frustration with its problems. Gerecht wrote a prescient article for The Atlantic magazine this summer in which he said the CIA's counterterrorism program in the Middle East is a myth. He says the United States missed an opportunity to penetrate Osama bin Laden's terrorist group, Al-Qaeda, in its formative years in the early 1990s. The CIA failed to seed the group with spies because, he says, the agency is still living in the Cold War, when the U.S. waited for disgruntled Soviets to volunteer to spy.
Despite whatever they like to say publicly, it's still based on the principles that were followed during the Cold War, which weren't all that successful then either, but it's much more likely that you'll get some KGB officer, a Soviet diplomat, to walk into an embassy or consulate or in another venue and volunteer his services than you will get an Islamic radical to volunteer his services to the United States government.
Gerecht says the only way to penetrate Islamic terrorist groups in Afghanistan, Pakistan, and other hostile countries is with what he calls non-official cover operatives native to the region without open ties to the United States government.
You're going to have to operate, develop a system whereby you have your own Muslim recruits. Now, it's very hard to do that. There certainly are ways to try, but it's going to take time. You're going to have failures. People are going to be put into harm's way, seriously into harm's way. Many of them will probably die. The agency is very much an American institution. It's highly risk adverse. It doesn't like doing that. It doesn't like putting its own officers into harm's way, and it doesn't even like putting foreigners into harm's way. So it's going to be brutally difficult for this institution to develop the ethos and the methodology to do this.
Vincent Canestraro, a former chief of CIA counterterrorism operations, says the devastating terrorist attacks on the World Trade Center and Pentagon revealed other weaknesses at his one-time employer. For one thing, the CIA is better at understanding terrorists motivated by secular grievances, the desire for a Palestinian homeland, for example, instead of religious ones.
The U.S. counterterrorism community in particular has very limited experience in understanding the nature of terrorism that derives from religiously oriented groups, whether they're domestic, such as Christian Identity, a white supremacist group that's driven by a very radical fundamentalist view of biblical injunctions, or of Al-Qaeda, which is driven by an extraordinarily perverse view of Islam.
Canestraro cited other intelligence-gathering defects. He skewered the CIA and FBI for failing to hire agents who speak native Arabic languages. He says the intelligence community has become far too reliant on high-tech satellite snooping equipment instead of human intelligence, and the government has hamstrung the CIA by limiting its ability to use spies who themselves may have committed human rights abuses.
It's a dirty, messy business, and you have to deal with people with blood on their hands because terrorists, by definition, have blood on their hands. We purged our roles of human rights abusers in the 1990s, and hundreds of agents were let go. Now, maybe the majority of them should have been let go, because it doesn't matter if you are caught short in some place like Latin America on a policy matter. It does matter in terms of human lives if you are caught short in a terrorist group. The FBI has means for dealing with this, having procedures in-house in the Justice Department to allow them to use a mafia informant like Sammy the Bull Gravano, who had 17 deaths on his hands. But he was used to peel back a mafia organization and prosecute several members of that group. CIA has got to have the same kind of ability.
Like the CIA, the FBI has also drawn fire for failing to avert the September 11th attacks. A few weeks before the terrorism, for example, the FBI arrested an Arab in Boston, but reportedly failed to act on a warning from French intelligence that he was linked to bin Laden's network and probably was intent on acts of terror. David Burnham, a former New York Times investigative reporter, is now co-director of Transactional Records Access Clearinghouse. His group found that the FBI has increased its surveillance of potential terrorists in the United States in recent years. Between 1992 and 1999, for example, the number of special judicial warrants obtained by the FBI for electronic surveillance and break-ins rose from 484 to 886. But for the FBI to really become an effective anti-terrorism agency, Burnham says, it may have to shift its priorities.
It is a fact that for many years, the FBI has spread itself very thinly and has tried to do too much. In recent years, it spent a huge part of its resources on drugs and a lot of resources on bank robbery. And organizations such as the Senate Appropriations Committee have argued that because of this confusion of purpose, that it has not spent enough time focusing on national security issues.
A spokesman for the FBI in Washington did not return a phone call or email. At the CIA, Tom Crispell, a spokesman, says Gerecht and Canestraro hadn't worked at the agency for nearly a decade, and their criticisms are largely unfounded. He says that in the past few years, the number of CIA agents who speak Arabic has tripled. Operatives have a much better understanding of fundamentalist groups, and he insists the CIA does not turn down potential spies because of unsavory pasts. A lot of people doubt our current capabilities, he says, but we'd say that those individuals who are most familiar with the CIA's current capabilities, like the president, the vice president, and the secretary of state, have a great deal of confidence in the agency and its leadership. For WBUR Special Coverage, I'm Jonathan Saltzman.
We're talking this hour about U.S. intelligence, agencies that compete instead of share, English-speaking spies in very foreign posts, operatives who hang around the American embassy waiting for a turncoat to come knocking. The list of weaknesses rolls on, and the September 11 attack has laid them all bare. Listeners, do you blame the CIA and the FBI for not preventing more than 6,000 deaths in New York, Washington, and Pennsylvania? Should the heads of these agencies step down? Can any one person be held accountable, or was it the failure of an entire system? Join the conversation at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255, or join us online at WBOR.org and click on Special Coverage Forums. Joining us tonight are two veterans of the intelligence community. Melvin Goodman served in the Central Intelligence Agency for 20 years. He is now a professor at the National War College. Good evening, Melvin Goodman.
Hello, Tom.
Good to have you with us. And Robert Steele.
Good
to have you. Robert Steele has had a 25-year career in national security. He's the author of On Intelligence, Spies and Secrecy in an Open World. Good evening, Mr. Steele.
Glad to be with you.
Here's the question, and let me put it to you first, Robert Steele. Can we expect more from our intelligence agencies than we saw on September 11th? What has gone wrong with U.S. intelligence services?
We can and should expect more, but not from these agencies as they're presently trained, equipped, and organized. What went wrong was as much a political failure as it was an intelligence and counterintelligence failure. It was a combination of complacency and ignorance. Complacency because we're simply unwilling to take ragheads seriously. That's what they're called.
Ragheads meaning?
Meaning ignorant people wearing rags on their head. There are not many people, I'd say not more than five people at CIA that understand that Islam is a knowledge-based religion and that in its time, Islam was by far the most advanced civilization on the earth.
And you're saying that the people who brought down the World Trade Center are seen as coming from an ignorant and incapable group?
Don't go too far down that road. The point is there's no one there that understands them. But let me finish my first point.
Yeah.
And ignorance, because we're simply not reading the Muslim papers and we don't have any people actually walking the ground outside the embassy. Raul's got it right. We're locked up inside our air-conditioned embassies and we don't have what it takes to get out on the street.
Mm. I just want to go back for a minute. You're talking about, use the phrase ragheads. This is a fairly unpleasant ethnic epithet.
But,
no, well, but I want to understand. Are you saying that there's an attitude within the intelligence agencies that these folks just in our league, they seem to have dealt us a pretty grievous blow?
There are a higher number of PhDs in Islamic terrorist groups, the PLO and the IRA, than most people realize. These are very smart people.
Got it. Melvin Goodman. You've heard Robert David Steele talk about complacency within the intelligence agencies. That has surely gone away since September 11. But do you agree that that had crept in during the 90s, and why?
Well, I think there were two periods that are important. In the 1980s, the CIA completely missed the decline and the eventual collapse of the Soviet Union and never bothered to study the problem, never conducted a post-mortem. I consider that a certain sign of bureaucratic complacency.
Mm.
In the 1990s, we had a series of signals about what Osama bin Laden was planning in terms of the World Trade Center, bombing the military barracks in Saudi Arabia, a plan to hijack 11 aircraft and even target CIA headquarters with one of these commercial airliners as a bomb. Now, that's incredible complacency when you learned in 1995 that this was the plan of al-Qaeda. But yet in 2000 and 2001, you send no urgent signal, no urgent sign that Osama bin Laden is really planning a terrorist operation inside the CIA, inside the United States, as opposed to military facilities overseas.
Melvin Goodman,
so
hold that thought.
This is incredible complacency.
I want to back up for just a second. Did you say that the U.S. intelligence services knew in 1995 that Osama bin Laden was considering using an airliner as a bomb?
In 1995, the intelligence community learned, and the CIA learned, that there was a plot planned by the same people who planned the World Trade Center bombing in 1993
mm-hmm.
To hijack aircraft, to use these aircraft as bombs, and that the CIA headquarters building was on the target list. Yes.
To not respond to that seems like the definition of complacency. I mean, that's incredible.
Well, it's mind-boggling to believe that the CIA could sit there and still believe that bin Laden's targets were only going to be in the Middle East and the Persian Gulf and not where the United States is the most vulnerable of all, which is at home.
And where was this information coming into the CIA at that time? This is from an internal report? Or
This is
internal reporting that the CIA had access to and presumably was shared within the intelligence community. So this is a failure not only within the CIA, but within the larger intelligence community, the 13 intelligence agencies of the so-called community, and also the policy community in terms of the way the Bush administration treated the Middle East and Southwest Asia when it took over in January, thinking it could walk away from some of the problems of the Middle East that are the systemic problems that have created some of the ground for this terrorism. Certainly not all of it, because we're dealing to a certain extent with nihilists in the Middle East.
Mm.
And I don't think we should confuse this with Islamic fundamentalism or Islamic revivalism. These are nihilists. They are out to destroy the United States. They have no constructive agenda whatsoever.
Let me just jump in and tell you.
Robert David Steele, hold that for a minute. We've got to take a quick break here. I'll give you 20 seconds, and then we'll go out.
A man blew himself up in the Philippines, and we got all of the plans for picking up 11 airplanes and blowing them up over the Atlantic. That was the beginning of what should have been our deeper understanding.
Listeners, we want to understand why U.S. intelligence agencies were not on top of what was going on behind the attacks on September 11th. We're listening, we're hearing, we're learning a lot. We want to hear from you. Join us at 1-800-423-TALK, 1-800-423-8255. Or get into the conversation online at WBUR.org. Click on Special Coverage Forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR Boston.
From Boston University, this is WBUR
Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking...
This fall, where no drama has gone before, inside the CIA.
There are no second chances.
Don't screw up.
And into the lives of the agents who make it work. The world is their crime scene.
We have a lead on the terrorists.
Ted, Trevor, score.
I'm on my way.
Do you have what I need?
The Agency, Thursday this fall.
We're talking this hour about U.S. intelligence. In the wake of one of history's biggest intelligence failures, the networks are premiering no fewer than three dramas this fall about spies. On the small screen, the agency might frown on second chances, but according to those who know intelligence in real life, the CIA hasn't wanted to take any chances lately. Listeners, do we have the stomach for the tactics that could dismantle a cell of Islamic terrorists? Are you prepared to take and lose lives in the dirty business of espionage? Can our open democracy tolerate tough, covert actions? We're talking with Melvin Goodman, a former Soviet analyst for the CIA and now professor of national security at the National War College. Also with us is Robert Steele, a 25-year veteran of the U.S. national security community and author of On Intelligence, Spies and Secrecy in an Open World. Join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Robert Steele, just before the break, we were talking about the need for coordination. Melvin Goodman was laying out the fact that we had a heads up that airliners could be used as bombs. But why wasn't that disseminated, and why didn't it turn into action that would prevent such an event?
Well, there are three specific reasons, and I really want to move away from the CIA at this point and focus on the leads that the FBI had in the year prior to the attack, and especially in the week prior to the attack. We are still entering information into the system with pencils and paper. We don't have the money invested in processing that we have spent $1 trillion on gold-plated collection satellites that we only process 3 to 5% of what they collect.
And we're still spending $30 billion a year on intelligence.
And we have 100,000 people going through the motions of thinking. We're not spending money on processing. We're not forcing the agencies to share information at the grassroots or bottom-line level. And last but not least, even though there is a very fine Center for Countering Terrorism, a CTC, they are more like a bureaucracy and a management staff than they are what the British had in World War II, which was an operational intelligence center to track and kill submarines.
Let's go to the horrible case in point. You've just said that we had information that we should have processed. Do you mean to say that we had enough information that we could have or should have known what was afoot on September 11th?
I am not going to second guess the past. I'm only going to use it to say that I know how Franklin Delano Roosevelt felt after Pearl Harbor. He felt relief because he finally had a lever to move the nation. Intelligence is not very important, but when intelligence books are selling right up there with Harry Potter, America is starting to pay attention. This is the only chance President Bush is going to have in our lifetime to do a new National Security Act that corrects all of these mistakes, all of these deficiencies that have been pointed out by no less than 10 commissions in the past 40 years.
Melvin Goodman, a House committee only today called for a cultural revolution in the U.S. intelligence agencies. There's talk of the need to start over. How on earth do we engineer a cultural revolution or start over?
Well, it could be done. One thing that you have to reverse and perhaps end is the militarization of the intelligence community.
Meaning
most
what?
Of the intelligence community really reports to the Department of Defense. Harry Truman set up the CIA correctly in 1947 as an agency that would be outside the policy process. It wouldn't be defending policy. It would be a source of objective and balanced reporting. We don't really have that anymore. The CIA does a lot of the bidding of the Justice Department and a lot of the bidding of the Pentagon, and the entire intelligence community is beholden to the Pentagon, which is responsible for over 90% of its budget and more than 90% of its personnel.
But what's wrong with that? The Pentagon is there to defend the country. What's wrong with intelligence?
It's right, but it's there to defend the country in tactical intelligence. They're concerned about battlefield intelligence. If you don't have strategic intelligence, if you can't back up and take the long-term view of what do terrorist organizations do, what will they be trying to do, what are their motives, what is their rationale, what drives them, the Pentagon isn't interested in that. I'll give you a very good example of an intelligence failure that was caused by this structure, and that was the absurd failure in 1998 to monitor the Indian nuclear test. This was unbelievable to me with a $30 billion budget.
That we didn't know about it.
The reason is we didn't know about it. We were totally surprised. It led to the defeat of the comprehensive test ban treaty in the Congress because the senators were appalled by this intelligence failure. So it was a costly failure. And I would blame it on the Pentagon's lack of interest in South Asia, the Pentagon's lack of interest in India, and the Pentagon's lack of interest in counterproliferation. And the CIA, which used to be interested in all of these things, now does not have priority in terms of targeting satellites and doing intelligence priorities. So our priorities are out of touch. And this militarization has to be reversed. One final thing. We say we have a director of Central Intelligence, and he is George Tenet. We don't have such an individual. He is not a director. And Governor Tom Ridge better learn this for his Office of Homeland Defense.
Meaning he's not really at the center of the intelligence
web. Well, he is not at the center of the intelligence community. He is beholden to the Pentagon. The Pentagon determines his budget and determines his personnel. And if Tom Ridge doesn't have a capability to bring in an all-source, raw reporting function under the Office of Homeland Defense, we're going to have the same kind of failure 2 years down the road.
Listeners,
because
if it wasn't
you need this centralization.
If it wasn't clear before, it's deadly clear now that we need top flight intelligence in the United States. Are we getting it? If not, why not? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Kevin is on the line. Welcome, Kevin. You're on the air.
Oh, thank you for taking my call.
Good to have you.
One thing that I've been disturbed by in the last week or two is it's been repeated by the administration that one of the problems that somehow that maybe this terrorist attack on September 11th could have been avoided if CIA, FBI, and so forth didn't have their hands tied, that they could have openly been, you know, providing resources to people with quote unquote bloody hands, that we should be hooking up again and having assets in other countries.
So you're saying the strictures put on by Congress in the 90s.
That's fine.
The reality is Noriega, Bin Laden, Saddam Hussein, these are all the kind of people that we've provided resources to. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if Bin Laden might not have been in the position he is today if it weren't for having dealt with them before those strictures were put into place.
Well, we know we have a long history there. Kevin thinks it's a good point, and it's a tough point because many Americans only a few years ago were protesting vociferously at the association of the CIA and others with human rights violators. It still doesn't sound or feel very good. Robert David Steele, how do we walk that razor's edge?
Let me put that one to rest, because I really strongly support the intent of Congress on that one, and I was in Central America. I did three back-to-back tours down there. I know those baby killers. Let me tell you in no uncertain terms, that is not the reason that CIA failed.
Are you saying we don't need to deal with bad guys? I want it, but I want to be sure I understand it. Are you saying we don't need to deal with the bad guys?
If you let me finish my point, I'll make it clear.
Lay it out.
We continue to hire young people right out of college because they're cheap and they're easy to clear. And we send these young people out to work on an embassy circuit, even if you cut them off from the liaison people and others that have done bad things. As Ruhl Gest said in his early remarks on your program, which was an excellent introduction.
The piece in the Atlantic Monthly.
We don't have anybody that is capable of going long and going deep and going native. These restrictions had absolutely nothing to do with the failure, and I'm tired of hearing about them.
Well, maybe there are two issues there. Let me ask that. Clearly, we need people on the ground who speak the language and who can blend in. But sometimes, might they not also be folks who are involved, let's say, in the drug trade in Central Asia, who may not be squeaky clean?
You're being distracted from the primary point which Mel was making.
Mm-hmm.
We are wasting 85% of the $30 billion, and we are wasting 85% of the 100,000 people because we have a system that is flawed by design, as Amy Ziegart says in her wonderful book, and it has been built up willy-nilly over the years, and there is no one in charge. One quick comment. I want to respond to the CIA spokesman that said that we've tripled our Arabic. Let me tell you that I believe that whether intentionally or not, CIA is actively deceiving the President of the United States with respect to their capabilities. I will use an example I'm personally familiar with.
Okay.
They have told the White House they doubled their Chinese analysts, their Chinese linguist fluent analysts.
Mm-hmm.
What they didn't tell the White House was they went from 2 to 4.
That is doubling, but it's not what it might suggest. Melvin Goodman, let me pursue this with you as well. We've heard a lot about the absence of feet on the ground. Our picture of CIA workers these days is folks in front of computer screens in Langley. Do we have the understanding of how to put intelligence agents on the ground in far corners of the world, fluent in the language, capable of blending in?
I don't think we do. Now, there are separate problems here. One is the language capability. The CIA just is not strong in terms of linguistics or languages.
How can that be? It's an international agency. How can that possibly?
In 1979, when Iran took over the embassy, the U.S. embassy in Tehran, we had one Farsi speaker from the CIA in Tehran, which is one more than the Directorate of Operations had back at headquarters. And this was a scandal that has not been corrected. So they must address this problem. Now, in terms of putting people on the ground, you are not going to put people out there with State Department cover and then have them effectively meet the kind of people you need to collect intelligence again. It goes back. It goes back to the point that was made earlier in the program about people with non-official cover and also working more closely with foreign liaison, which CIA and FBI are loath to do. The fact of the matter is the greatest successes we've had against working with Al-Qaeda and the real terrorist organizations with global capabilities has been from working with foreign liaison. And it makes CIA and FBI uncomfortable from a counterintelligence standpoint. But we could learn a lot from the Egyptians. We could learn a lot from the Jordanians. We can learn a lot from other Islamic societies. Sudan cooperated with us in 1996, and they were ready to turn over Osama bin Laden. Our prize for Sudan was to bomb a pharmaceutical plant in 1998 when we didn't have the intelligence to even justify thinking about such a step, and the CIA lied about the kind of intelligence support they gave to the White House.
Melvin Goodman,
so this is a very serious problem we're talking about, and we shouldn't just talk around the edges.
Let's not, but I want to get through the language a bit. We're lay folks here. When you say we need people with non-official cover, what do you mean?
In other words, we have to get people into countries who are not there under the auspices of, say, the State Department or the Defense Department or is there as a military attaché.
So they might look like a civilian or business person?
We have to put a civilian, a student, a businessman who can stay in that country for 5 to 10 years, learn something about the society, make some contacts, learn something about what drives the government party or the opposition party. And then maybe after a period of time, then the CIA contacts this person. This would be the kind of sleeper that bin Laden introduced in this country, which worked so well. This is what we have to get back to think that someone with State Department cover and a coat and tie working out of the embassy in some of these nasty places is going to collect good clandestine intelligence, let alone infiltrate these groups, which I think is virtually impossible, particularly the nihilistic terrorist organizations, is a leap of faith. And I don't think you can organize an intelligence community if it's a genuinely serious intelligence community around that basis.
Listeners, we're talking about a cultural revolution in the U.S. intelligence services. Are you ready for this? Do we feel comforted at all? Tom is on the line. Welcome, Tom.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Well, you're painting quite a picture of our intelligence community, and I guess I really want to net it out to one question. Have we been lucky over the past several years and decades, and are our failings actually catching up with us now, or are there some wins that just, aren't being talked about simply because of the nature of the business?
Right. Got it. That's a good question. Thank you, Tom. Let me put it to Robert David Steele. Tom asks, have we been lucky over the last decade or more? And also, have there been some successes that haven't made headlines?
There have been some successes that have made headlines, and I'm very glad to have a chance to talk about them because this should absolutely not turn into a CIA bashing. CIA is a very important agency. We need it. I'm an advocate of tough love. but I don't want to kill them to the point that they can't hunt anymore. That's absurd.
And we all know that not the sun and moon and stars cannot be expected, but we want what should be expected.
I'm with you, Tom. Now, CIA, I think, and other agencies had enormous success during the Gulf War in flushing the terrorists and keeping them moving. They have had their good things. I'm very proud of some of the things that I did when I was with them. Now, I really want to come back to languages and the FBI. The FBI captured a house full of documents when the World Trade Center was bombed the first time. They still haven't read more than 5% of those documents. I'm speculating.
Because?
They have said in public, in writing, they simply don't have translators to read every document they capture in Arabic or Farsi or Urdu. That's outrageous.
But we are a multicultural country, quite famously. We ought to be able to come up with those resources, shouldn't we?
Now you're getting to the bottom line, which is we insist that everybody who speaks a foreign language that works on documents we've captured, which are presumably known to the people we captured them from, have a top secret clearance and be trustable with the president's key to the bathroom. That's a contradiction in terms.
Mm-hmm.
We have gotten so obsessed with security, we've built a wall that shuts out the entire world.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Melvin Goodman, what resources do we have that are in hand or close to hand that we ought to be using and aren't?
Well, we have extremely good technical resources, and I think these resources are very important. The satellite capability to take pictures, to intercept signals, has been very important in terms of how the Cold War was waged, making sure the Soviet Union never introduced a weapon system that we didn't have advance knowledge of. There was very good intelligence analysis done in the 1970s on the Sino-Soviet dispute and how to exploit that dispute. If Kennedy and Johnson had listened to the CIA in the 1960s, we would not have made the mistake of going into Vietnam the way we did. So the potential is there, and I agree with Bob. You need a central intelligence agency. But the problem with this central intelligence agency, it has ignored its own strategic asset. It has ignored the purpose of doing long-term strategic analysis, stepping back and taking the long view. And this is a process that started in the 1980s under Bill Casey and Bob Gates. The CIA never did a postmortem of its failure with regard to the Soviet Union. And if you would take any organization and have it led by a group of very average, very mediocre people for 20 years, you will eventually derogate that organization. Mm-hmm. And when you look at Casey and Gates and Deutsch and Woolsey and Tenet and Judge Webster over a 20-year period, mm-hmm. what in the world do you expect the CIA to be at this point in time?
Mm. Robert Steele, 30 seconds before our next break. George Tenet, director of the CIA, should he stay or should he go?
George needs to go. He is a staffer by attitude and mentality, and he has no vision and no fire in his belly.
Listeners, what do you think? We're talking about the state of U.S. intelligence services and how we can buff it up to protect ourselves from threats coming down the road. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Or continue the conversation online at WBUR.org. Click on Special Coverage Forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR Boston.
From Boston University, this is
WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about U.S. intelligence services with Melvin Goodman and Robert Steele. Melvin Goodman is a 20-year veteran of the CIA and a professor at the National War College. Robert David Steele has a 25-year career in national security. He's the author of On Intelligence, Spies and Secrecy in an Open World. Callers, what is the role of intelligence in the post-Cold War era? Is it time for Congress to open its wallet to the intelligence agencies? Or do they have enough already and need to use it better? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Melvin Goodman, just before the break and throughout this hour, we've been talking a lot about the CIA, but we all know vaguely that the intelligence community includes more than that. There's the NSA, there's the FBI, and an alphabet soup of agencies that most of us aren't even familiar with. Give us the bigger picture. How does this fit together? Does the FBI have an important role here? What about the NSA? Is that all technology? How's the puzzle fit together?
Well, it doesn't really fit together. And the label intelligence community is really a misnomer. There is no community. They don't function as a community. They function as competing agencies, and they have turf wars, and they worry about protecting their rice bowl. And it's clear that the FBI doesn't share its raw intelligence with CIA. And until the Aldrich Ames scandal, it was clear that the CIA wasn't sharing its information with the FBI. So dispel this notion of community. It's very competitive, and it doesn't function
on that basis. Got it. So it's not a community, but yet there are different pods of resources, expertise, people, technology.
Right.
What role should we look to FBI, NSA to play?
Well, FBI has the very important role in the battle against terrorism, given it's a law enforcement agency, of monitoring the terrorist presence in the United States. Mm-hmm. Now, we know this wasn't done very well. It's clear that the FBI had a watch list, but it's not clear they were watching the people on the list. And the problem there is the Cold War syndrome. The FBI still puts too much attention into watching the Russian embassy in Washington and Russian consulates in New York mm-hmm. and in San Francisco. They do the same thing with regard to the Chinese, and they don't pay enough attention to the people who can really hurt us, the mm-hmm. people who want to destroy us, the people who want to bring us down. And until the FBI gets away from its old agenda and gets serious about the issue of terrorism and counterterrorism, I'm afraid we're going to see this kind of activity again. And if you look at the CIA, again, you have the same problem of ignoring strategic intelligence, actually ignoring languages. One of the most important functions of the CIA when I was there was the Federal Broadcasting Information Service, FBIS, which was so important to analysts and scholars, in which people actually did read foreign newspapers and analyzed what was in the open media.
Are you saying that's not going on?
It's not going on anymore in terms of analysis of this information. All of the analysts have left from FBIS, and now they're trying to rebuild the function of reading foreign papers, but it's going to take a long time to get back to where they were 20 years ago.
Listeners, we're learning more every minute here, but not much of it is very comforting. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Join us. Stephen is on the line. Welcome, Stephen. You're on the air.
Tom, how are you?
We're very well tonight. Thanks.
I want to ask your guests and you. We've heard so much, and maybe I'm bastardizing the quote and not quoting the quoter properly. I think we've heard very often in recent weeks, since September 11th, Thomas Jefferson's comment, there are no permanent friends or enemies, only permanent interests.
Okay.
And in light of that, I don't think it's I'm being an alarmist by shifting the focus of this conversation just ever so slightly and talking about what we're facing at this moment with the instability of this conflict, the lack of proof syndrome that other nations are asking for, and the potential of government coups in moderate Islamic states.
So what do you want to see, Stephen?
What right now are we facing? What kind of intelligence do we have that can help us really determine who's going to really be on our side, whom we can trust, and what lies ahead in the coming weeks?
There is a lot of instability staring us in the face. We've been talking at a very high level, but let's bring it right up to date and down to the nitty-gritty. Robert David Steele, we're trying to find Osama bin Laden, for one thing. Melvin Goodman has expressed some lack of confidence that we can actually infiltrate his organization at the top anyway, al-Qaeda. What are the chances of us pulling this off? What do we need to do to accomplish it from the intelligence side?
Bin Laden is a dead man. He will be dead within 2 years. Not soon, I don't think, but within 2 years. That is a tactical problem. Behind bin Laden are 100,000 young men that are well-educated, middle-class, religious. This is faith-based terrorism, and I don't think the Beltway understands that yet.
Mm-hmm.
These people are going to keep on coming unless we do two things. The first thing is I am inclined to agree with Senator Shelby that we need to move terrorism into some kind of independent operational entity that is separate from the FBI, which does law enforcement very well. It's separate from the CIA, which does its button-down collar analysis very well, at least in the areas I'm familiar with. And we need to have something that actually focuses on manhunts. We don't do manhunts well.
And this would not be Tom Ridge and Homeland Security, obviously.
I'd like to talk about Tom Ridge at the end of the program.
So lay it on us.
He has been locked in a closet.
Mm-hmm.
Comparing him to Condi Rice is the kiss of death.
I haven't heard that, but you mean he's not.
If he has
Pope
no agency,
troops?
If he has no agency, if he has no budget, if he doesn't have a Homeland Defense Analysis Center, if he doesn't have an op intel capability for working with all of these agencies, the Coast Guard, the Immigration Naturalization Service, the Border Patrol, all of these people are going to ignore him in the same way that Mel Goodman has pointed out the Department of Defense Agency, Signals Intelligence, Imagery Intelligence, the Defense Intelligence Agency, the hundreds of thousands, I mean the tens of thousands of people in tactical intelligence, they all ignore George Tenet.
Melvin Goodman, coming to you for last thoughts, I hear Robert Steele saying we've got to go to root causes, but we've also got to make this work in the field. Are you confident that we can turn this around, that Congress and the executive arm are focused enough on it to do it?
Well, Congress, unfortunately, has been part of the problem. Let's face it. Shelby was ahead of the chief of the Senate Intelligence Committee for a long time. He was responsible for oversight, and he did very little oversight. So don't count on anything from Shelby. The best thing we can do now is to step back and look at the countries that have dealt with nihilist organizations before and done so successfully.
We're going to have to leave it there for tonight, Melvin Goodman. I'm afraid we're out of time there. Melvin Goodman, thank you very much for joining us this evening, and also our thanks to Robert David Steele. Melvin Goodman served in the CIA for 20 years. He's now a professor at the National War College. Robert Steele is a 25-year veteran of the U.S. national security community and author of On Intelligence, Spies and Secrecy in an Open World. Thank you to you both.
You're welcome.
You can continue this conversation online. Click on WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage Forums. Each night, we're hearing the voices of people around the country in the form of radio diaries. Tonight, we take you to a bingo game in Warwick, Rhode Island. The retirees at the Pilgrim Senior Center have now lived through two attacks on American soil.
Order the G, number 59.
I'm Ed Greer. I'm retired. Been retired about 12 years, and I was chief of the Division of Food Protection for the state of Rhode Island. I saw the second plane hit the building, the second tower. I just, my heart sank, I guess. And I thought to myself, what a crazy world we live in. I remember Pearl Harbor, and I was of age eligible for service. And signed up for the service immediately, as a lot of young men, 17 and 18 years of age, did at that time. And today, I just worry about my grandsons, who are of the age that are eligible for a service, and wonder what the future is for our grandchildren and for our descendants to come. I just hope and pray that this world can straighten out and fly right. We've had such a good life in the past 50 years since the termination of the World War II, and things recovered, and we were more concerned with luxuries of our life. And those things are so insignificant when you think of what's happened in the world today. And SUVs are so unimportant, whether I own one or don't have one. There's so many people in the world that travel with their just by foot and wagons and oxen and so forth. I'm hoping that the various countries of the world will all work as a team to abolish this possibility of terrorism. That we'll all work. China and Russia, who we've had conflict with and disagreements with over the past years. We all seem to be on the same team right now, and I hope and pray that it stays that way, and that the long-range effects of this event will actually bring the world closer together.
My name is Vertil Patterson, and I'm from Warwick, and I do senior aid at the Pilgrim Senior Center. And my thoughts on the terrorist attack was really horrifying, I guess you could say. It's horrible when you think about bodies just blown apart and never be found again. That's the sad part to me. It affects me knowing that I have people, I have relatives that work for the airline. I know people that work in the investment in New York. And just to know that a mother and a father, a sister, a brother left to go to work that morning and never return home, that's a terrible feeling. And knowing that our sons and loved ones and husbands and friends have to be sent off to war. And we don't know what to expect and who we're really fighting. And we don't know how long it's been planned, how long this attack has been planned, and what more is to come. I know that to some extent the United States have gone beyond to try to make us feel safe and secure, but we don't feel that safe. I don't, and I know a lot of people, other people probably don't. And what the future holds, we don't know what it holds. I don't even think the president knows what he's doing right now. He's just feeling his way, trying to figure out which way to go. Oh, God, I want to see peace, but I don't think it's going to be peace. I really don't. I'd like to see the enemy be caught, but I hate to think of the lives that's going to be jeopardized looking for something, somebody that we don't know who we're looking for and how many. I think we will have a war, and I'm not ready for that.
Number 59.
Dominic DiGregorio. I was a plumbing and heating contractor. I still can't believe it, and I'm surprised that the president didn't do anything a little earlier or do something real, whatever. I was in the service, but it's nothing like being in the service. This here, 6,000 people lost their lives. It's unbelievable how they could do something like this with hardly any money at all. They've chaosed the whole world. But I hope they do something real quick, whatever they can do. I don't know what they can do.
Thank you.
Ed Began, and I'm from Warwick. I'm a veteran, and I am retired from 9X, New England Tel. This is the first time that actually we supplied them the equipment to do the damage they had. That was the thing that was most frustrating. And as I say, it made me angry that they could get away with something like this. As I say, World War II, we knew who the enemy was, and you could do something about it. This particular case, the enemy could be living right next door to you. You'd never know it. It's something you have to live with. As I say, you're in a new century now, and as I say, the enemies are different than in our time, and it's going to be a continuing problem all the way through. So it's going to take time to adjust to it. And I think, as the U.S., it takes us a long time to, shall we say, get frustrated. But when we do, as I say, we succeed. Everyone comes together. As I say, I doubt seriously it'll be in my lifetime. And I hope in my children's lifetime that it'll be completed. But I'm afraid that it'll go into the grandchildren and the like of that. I mean, you figure that World War II, we figured we had straightened out everything and there was going to be no problem. Korea, likewise, you say, hey, this was a mini battle, but it wasn't. And you say, that has straightened out the world. And then you get into Vietnam and you say, hey, finally we're going to straighten out the world. And it looks like this time here, as I say, it's going to be extremely long. But I think before we finish, we will end up with a better world.
Ed Greer, Vertil Patterson, Dominic DiGregorio, and Ed Began spend their afternoons at the Pilgrim Senior Center in Warwick, Rhode Island. Over the next few weeks, you'll be hearing more radio diaries from around the country. We'd like to hear from you. Send your submissions for next week's radio diaries by email. The address is special@wbur.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to special coverage from WBUR Boston.